Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What's shaking, everybody? What is shaking? Did you see the steak dance this week? I hope you did. If you didn't send me a steak dance, you need to send me a steak dance. Anyway, check out the steak dance, hashtag steak dance on Instagram. I just want to see people happy eating animal foods, happy in general. I'm excited. I'm going to keep steak dancing. I'm going to get everybody that I can on this show to steak dance. You'll keep hearing about the steak dance. In other news, I had an awesome week. I went to Low Carb San Diego. I got to hang out with my buddy Ken Berry. You guys heard that podcast last week. It was super fun. Really enjoyed it. Check that one out. I think you guys will really enjoy it. This week, I had an amazing guest who is really a hero of mine. His name is Gary Fetke. He is an Australian orthopedic surgeon, and he has such an interesting story. So basically, Gary Fetke's story is that he was really concerned about the hospitals in Australia feeding patients, his patients, diabetic patients, lots of sugar. He's in there, you know, trying to remove diabetic foot ulcers. He's having to completely remove diabetic feet. And in reverse of that, they're feeding him a bunch of junk in the hospital. So he wanted to fight against that. And what happened? The dietitians came after him saying it wasn't safe. And the cereal industry in Australia actually put him on a blacklist. And there's this sort of intrigue story. It's almost like a spy story about Gary Fetke. He got put on trial. The Australian Medical Board sanctioned him. And eventually he was completely cleared. And he's become a real hero because of all the things that he had to go through, all the stressful things he had to go through to fight for what he believed was right, which was a low-carbohydrate diet, for his diabetic patients, really for almost everybody. So Gary is an amazing guy. In the process of understanding why the cereal industry in Australia and in the world, but his experience began in Australia, was so peeved about what he was saying, he and his wife really went into the history books and tried to understand where the nutritional guidelines came from. What they found was really striking, and you'll hear about it in this podcast. So the beginning part of the podcast is my conversation with Gary about his history, what happened to him, why he was sanctioned, and that'll segue directly into this idea that the cereal companies had it out for him because they saw profits going down, and they put him on a blacklist, and they just really tried to get him. And then we talk about the really cool stuff, the revisionist history part of this podcast, where we learn that many of the nutritional guidelines that we have in the U.S. today came from the American Dietetics Association, which was started by Seventh-day Adventists. And this is not to criticize any religion, but it is to perhaps raise the possibility that mixing religious views, like those of the Seventh-day Adventists, with nutritional policy that affects everyone in the world or country is not the appropriate thing. As you'll hear in this podcast, in the early 1900s, 1915, John Harvey Kellogg of Kellogg's Cereals was in a Seventh-day Adventist family. He was a typesetter, and he was really indoctrinated, in some ways perhaps brainwashed. And the concerns with the Seventh-day Adventist church were that meat and animal foods made people libidinous, carnal, right? This is what happens when we get the right nutrients. Our hormones actually work. So the intention with cereals was to use them as a hormonal break, to use them as a chemical castrating thing, as a physical castrating thing. Fiber in cereals will destroy your libido because they're so nutritionally worthless. So it's a really interesting history. It's a great walk down sort of historical avenues and understanding the sneaky parts of how these things came to be and how the Seventh-day Adventist Church is still working in today's world, and how many of the nutritional guidelines and how many of the things we're seeing now are probably related to political, religious agendas. So it's really cool. I think you guys are really going to dig it. I thought it was an amazing conversation. Gary is a great dude. Okay, this podcast is also sponsored by my boys, Ancestral Supplements. I so appreciate these guys. They're such good people, and they make a great product, you guys. It's a grass-fed Oregon complex from New Zealand. They do nose-to-tail organ meats, bone marrow, prostate, in simple, convenient gelatin capsules. The narrative here is really compelling. Traditional peoples, Native Americans, early ancestral healers believe that eating organs from a healthy animal would strengthen and support the health of the corresponding organ of the individual. If I were hunting an animal, I would certainly eat the whole animal. I would definitely have eaten the prostate. It's really hard to get a prostate, so I take the prostate supplement, and it's a really unique product, potentially for prostate health. What we know is that the traditional way of treating a person with a weak heart was to feed the person the heart of a healthy animal. Similarly, eating the kidneys of an animal was believed to support urinary ailments and overall kidney health. Pancreas was fed to people with digestive and endocrine problems. Bovine prostate provided prostate-specific building blocks to nourish and support one's own prostate health. I love this idea of eating nose to tail, and I'm so fascinated by eating more of the organs in my own diet. And I think it's such an interesting endeavor to understand what unique nutrients we might be getting in these organs that are left out in muscle meat. And I really appreciate what Ancestral Supplements is doing here. So check out ancestralsupplements.com to see what they can do for you. They are putting back in what the modern world has left out. Use the code SaladinoMD on their Shopify site to get 10% off. And then an important question, are you an insider? What is an insider? A fundamental health insider is somebody who gets my newsletter every week or so. I put in an article that I think is cool. I talk about what's going on with me, what's going on with the podcast, talk about stuff I like. Check it out. Fundamentalhealthinsider.com to subscribe. I think you will find value in it. If you don't, you can email me and tell me it stinks and tell me how to make it better, and I will, because I'm working real hard on that thing. Okay, without further ado, on to the podcast, my friends. This one is awesome. You're going to love it. All right, Dr. Gary Fetke, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here, my friend.
Yeah, it should be a bit of fun, Paul.
I think we'll have a little bit of fun. So we were just chatting before we started recording, and we are here in sunny San Diego. It sounds like you went out for a boat trip this morning and maybe saw some dolphins, or do you see any sharks?
No sharks. We've got them all at home.
In Tasmania.
We've got plenty of... welcome to Tasmania. We've got our sharks and we've got our spiders and our snakes. So, you know, stay away, and I'm going to keep everyone out of Tasmania because it's a perfect paradise.
It's got a lot of poisonous... There are a lot of poisonous animals in Tasmania, aren't there?
There are a few poisonous dietitians as well.
Poison, right. There's a lot of venom.
To be fair, you know, we don't have... I don't see that many snakes and that many spiders, but we do have them around. But, you know, it's Tasmania is, I think, is the haven when Armageddon hits the planet. You know, we're fossil fuel free with our electricity. We're arable land. We've got a temperate climate. It's a bit cold down there at the moment. It's 2 degrees Celsius, which is, I think, about 34, 35.
Sounds cold.
So it is cold, but... it's green, and we live on a farm. We've got we're pretty sufficient from electricity and water, and we're passive solar. So we've got this really nice house, and it's I'm ready to evacuate the planet down there.
Sounds amazing. If things go south, I'm going to come down and say hi to you there.
No, I just keep reminding everyone, you know, lots of spiders and snakes, and stay away.
Yeah,
we've got it under control. Just leave me alone on my island paradise.
Is that where you were practicing medicine?
I started in Sydney. I did my medical training in Sydney and then in Victoria, which is... now I'm in Tasmania. I've been orthopedic surgeon there for over 25 years.
Are you still... You're still practicing?
Absolutely.
Still seeing patients and operating and stuff?
Absolutely.
And in the intro, I talked a little bit about your bio, but let's... I think your story is so illustrative and has served as kind of a beacon for so many people. Let's go into a little bit of your story from your perspective. I'd love to hear you retell it. What happened to you? What you went through and where you've come to now? Because this is a clarion call for the rest of us in the medical world to kind of wake up. So what happened to you when you were practicing medicine?
Well, I've got my own health story, which is sort of a side one, but I've been practicing preventative health for 25 years. I mean, I know that sounds like we're supposed to all be doing it, but I was one of the first surgeons to not operate if people were smoking. And I've had a big, strong advocacy role for off-road motorbike injuries and that aspect. But over the last 10, 15 years, I've been... My practice, my patients are getting fatter and sicker. I'm, you know, forget the word obese. Let's say what's happening. They're just getting too heavy on their joints. I became pretty well the surgeon looking after diabetic foot complications for Northern Tasmania. And I started, you know, once every 4 or 6 weeks, I'd be nibbling away on some toes and, you know, trimming a bit of foot here and there. And it just started becoming, you know, a weekly event. And then it became partial amputations just on a week by week basis. And my clinics on a Friday were just filled with patients requiring more and more debridements of their feet. And I was seeing firsthand the complications of that week in, week out. And they were, you know, my Fridays at the hospital were called Fetke's Effed Up Fructose Free Fungating Foot Folly Fridays. And if you can follow that, and that's the truth. Everyone sort of, and I'd say to the medical students, come down here, you're going to see more diabetic foot complications in one afternoon than hopefully you'll ever see in your medical practice. And this is a completely preventable condition. Whether or not you're type 2 or type 1 diabetes, complications of it are completely preventable. And going back 8-10 years, my patients with diabetes, complicated in hospital, were being fed 3 ice creams per day. On top of, you know, in retrospect now, you know, and still ongoing, sugar-coated, you know, carb-loaded breakfasts, and have your, wash your tablets down with orange juice, and then desserts being served 3 times a day, in between snacks being chocolate biscuits followed with a bit of fruit juice. And I'm trying to control their blood glucose. I'm trying to actually save their feet, literally, and forget other diabetic complications. Now, there was a time when I had 4 inpatients that were having dialysis every day. I'd go down to the dialysis unit. They only got a 6-bed dialysis room, and 4 of the patients in there were mine. So I'd go and have a chat about this. And these are patients you get to know over a long period of time. This is, you know, it's not you see them one day, you've got a sore knee, we scope your knee and you're out the door. You get to know these people over 6 months, years even. And I'm saying, you know, can you stop serving them all that ice cream? And then I'm being told, hang on, this is the hospital food guidelines. And I said, you've got to be kidding. And so then I started looking into sugar. I had my own health story, my weight. I had a tumour 20 years ago, but I started looking into sugar and particularly fructose, and that's where it started. And then over a period of time, I went, hang on, gave a medical grand round, a surgeon giving a medical grand round, which was pretty phenomenal, and started talking about sugar. And then I started realising how much junk food's in hospital, how much is being sold by the kiosks. And it's right around the world. It's not just Tasmania. And I started questioning. And then I started recommending we should be cutting down on sugar and junk food. You know, wow, this is, you know, how dangerous is that? And along the way, the dietitians at the hospital started getting their noses out of joint. And then they involved their parent body, the Dietitians Association of Australia. And then the hospital was put under pressure to effectively to silence me. And I said, no. You know, this is inappropriate. We've got to do the right thing by our patients. And then lo and behold, I ended up getting reported to the Medical Board of Australia on 3 occasions, ultimately, for recommending my patients and ultimately the community to cut back on sugar and processed food. All the time I'm developing this model of nutrition and learning more and having to defend the ground a lot more. And then I came up with that nutritional model of inflammation, which is that perfect storm of sugar, refined carbs and polyunsaturated oils. And when you put all that together, that's inflammation. Obviously, when you think you've worked out the answer to a whole lot of stuff, you start talking about it. I got involved in social media, became louder. The Dietitians Association got crankier, not just my hospital, but, you know, the national body. And right in the midst of it, and we only found this out in 2018, you know, let's go back 2013, 2014. In 2014, the cereal industry in Australia, the Australian Breakfast Cereal Manufacturers Forum, they meet every 3 months. The CEOs, we're talking about Nestle, we're talking about Kellogg's, Freedom Food, Sanitarium, head of the Food and Grocery Council, you know, the peak people behind the peak bodies, meet together at a golf club and have, you know, discuss things. But there was a briefing paper saying profits are down in the cereal industry and the concepts of low carb and paleo are to blame. And this whole concept needs to be targeted. And in fact, these 8 people need to be targeted. And I was on that list. And I was the only doctor, the only health care professional talking preventative health in the public spectrum that it was, you know, there targeted this, you know, this needs to be targeted defence. So you know, here it is, and we, as I say, we only found this out late last year.
But last year, you discovered that in 2014, 2013, when you were making your rounds at the hospital and beginning to think, hey, all this sugar and junk food is not doing these diabetics any favors. I'm cutting off their feet. There was actually a meeting. This is the kind of stuff that people think is conspiracy theory, but it's so fascinating to hear that it's actually true and actually happening.
It's not a conspiracy when you've got 600 pages of internal documents of the cereal industry.
And you guys got a hold of that.
Yes.
And they actually had your name on a list saying, target this guy.
Yeah, with media. We're going to do this by media. And it had the people in the media named that they were going to work with.
And what were they planning to do against you?
They were just going to start rubbishing us. And then a series of articles come out in the national press. There's social media activity against you. It's really trying to denigrate the person. And, you know, we've got articles where they're saying, and it goes through separate parties, but the reporters are the ones that are actually on that list that are actually painting you in a bad light. You know, like, oh, this guy's, you know, one of the times I got reported to the medical board for inappropriately being involved in reversing someone's diabetes.
What?
Yeah, I know. This is, but in the midst of it, then there's this national, you know, the two major national newspapers are there going, there's an article in there saying, well, you can't trust this guy because he's currently under investigation for giving nutritional advice. He's currently under investigation by the National Medical Board. And so, you know, that paints, it's, you know, it's not a good look. And so, you know, it's just putting, you know, doubts in the reader's mind. Oh, crikey, this guy's under investigation by the National Board. Whatever he's talking about is dangerous. I was talking about reducing sugar and processed food and junk food and the hospital environment. And you can't help but laugh. But, I thought this was a joke for a few years. But it kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I get reported again. Which is a segue into where things went from there. They came in with one expert witness. And the expert witness at that time, very high profile in the nutritional world, was actually working for Sanitarium, which is a breakfast cereal company.
In Australia?
Well, no, they've actually got an international spectrum.
Right, and we'll talk about Sanitarium in more detail later when we get into where the nutritional guidelines came from. So,
I'm here defending the fact that we've got no endocrinologists in northern Tasmania. You know, I'm doing the diabetic feet. You know, it's my role because no one else is helping these patients. And I'm being told, no, that's inappropriate for surgeons to be involved in patient, you know, in nutritional advice. And I'm saying, look, my first letters after my name are MBBS, which in Australia is MD, which is doctor. You know, we all do the same biochemistry, physiology. We all do the basic stuff exactly the same. So since when did my first degree nullify my future letters after my name? And this was just falling on deaf ears. Ultimately, they, you know, took on board the expert witness advice that, you know, it's inappropriate for surgeons because they're not qualified.
Who did they think was qualified? Did they say that only the dietitian should be giving advice to patients on food?
Indirectly, okay. But and this became in the midst of it. Then there was a Senate inquiry into the medical review process in Australia. I became the test case because of how ludicrous all of this was. And in the midst of that, I presented about the failings of the medical system. And within 2 hours, this is under parliamentary privilege. You know, I don't, similar around the world. If you ask to give advice to a Senate inquiry, that's pretty high profile stuff. And 2 hours after I gave a pretty adverse, evidence against the Medical Board of Australia, they then handed down a determination against me. You know, the timing was suspiciously coincidental, I think, was what one of the reports was. And that advice was, I am not allowed to provide nutritional advice because by way of my degree, I was not qualified.
That's just so staggering to think that in Australia, they said a surgeon, a physician,
a doctor,
a doctor, yeah, could not provide nutritional advice to their patients because, and as we'll find out later, or as is really the root cause driving all of this, because of the radical or counter business interest information that you were suggesting to people, to clients, to patients.
And we have that in writing. And that, so that is it's a sloppy document, but that was what was written down. You know, by way of my medical degree, I'm not qualified to give nutritional advice. So that's a damnation across not just myself, but across all doctors in Australia. And by extrapolation, Tim Noakes is under the same, you know, pump at the same time, and Tim and I have become good friends over a long period of time now. Total respect, I think, for each other, because we just stood our ground on it. Tim's case was very open in court. Mine was behind closed doors. But we both respectively had the same finding, and it was really appropriate to keep fighting it. And so there ended up being investigations into the medical board as a result of it. They did some they effectively bullied and harassed me after by giving that advice. They then put out media releases related to this, one specifically naming me, and then there was a second one saying actually doctors can give advice, and then, well, that's silly, because that came out a few days after the one saying that I can't. So there was confusion in the population. They were doing some media material which was in fact quite inappropriate putting me in a bad name. And quite defamatory. So we're still in the process of trying to sort all that out. But effectively, the ruling at that time for myself was that if I continued to give any nutritional advice along that line and in any forum, then I was going to be deregistered. And I kept challenging that over and over and over. It had to involve the National Health Ombudsman, and it took another 2 years of fighting and discussing, and ultimately it finally went off to an independent medical board, and they reviewed it and they threw it out within 2 weeks and said, we're sorry.
How did you feel when all that was going down? I mean, how did you feel when you're sitting in front of these people and you're getting told you're not able to give medical advice, you can't give nutritional advice to people, or we are going to disbar you, we're going to take away your license? And in your mind, you're thinking, what I am doing here is the most basic intervention that these people absolutely need to have. They need to stop eating sugar. How is that all landing for you?
I'll say it's somewhat easier if you know you're right. And I think I needed to be trained into that. 25 years ago, I wouldn't operate on smokers because of the higher risk of complications. And I knew I was right. And I didn't cop nearly as much flack as I did this time around. But this, we knew we were right. But it just kept on snowballing, and the expenses are going up, and I'm getting, the media are getting hold of it in some respect. The doctors in my town are going, I couldn't just be about sugar. It must be about something else. And so your referral base drops off. Your patients are questioned. Actually, my patients were great. They knew me. They knew I was honest. They knew I had their best interests. So I had patients that were, incredibly loyal, and I had doctors that were loyal to me. But I know it affected my referral base, because people go, oh, there's got to be more to that. But no, it wasn't. It was just about I was advising patients to reduce sugar. There was never a case of a patient being harmed. There was no patient complaint to the medical board. There was no doctor complaint to the medical board. This was completely stirred up by the dietitians.
Who was reporting you? You said that three people reported you. They were all dietitians?
We definitely know that two were dietitians, because it's an anonymous reporting process in Australia. The third was almost certainly a dietitian, from everything we can find out. And we know who the dietitians were, because, if you're going to put evidence against me into the medical board, you should not leave your Facebook friends down the side of the page. Tasmania is a small enough community. You can work out who was involved in it. So in that process, and I actually asked the medical board, if you're going to actually make me respond to this, I actually need to know the qualifications of the person who's made it.
You have the right to know your accuser.
Well, no, you don't. Not in Australia. It's not the national law. It is just a ridiculous law. It's been thrown together. I've actually even done a talk on that on YouTube. You know, we shouldn't be throwing rocks in glass houses. We have a really ridiculous system in Australia, which is still evolving. It's got a long way to go because vexatious complaints can get as far as they did with me. So I can literally go on and say, you know, that person's done that and you're investigated, you're guilty until proven otherwise. It's really archaic. And then you're investigated in a star chamber by people who are too busy, they don't have enough resources, and then they just throw it in too hard basket, or they just said, actually, we'll take the expert witness, I will just silence this guy.
What were they actually, on the complaints, what were they saying you were doing that was so wrong?
That what I was recommending was harmful and that I was going to cause damage. The second complaint, as I said, was that I was about, what included not only the inappropriate reversal of diabetes, but also this one of that I was about to speak to the national hospital food industry, and I'd previously been, and they actually said the complaint was that I might sway the hospital food industry, which would affect the quality of the food in hospitals and nursing homes, and that was dangerous because what I was recommending was dangerous. But in a couple of years before I'd actually given a talk, I was invited, both occasions, invited. I didn't go to the hospital food industry. They invited me to speak. And my second slide was, hospital food is killing my patients, which is a figure of speech. The medical board then came back to me and they said, look, we've done a review of the hospital records and, in fact, none of your patients have actually died as a result of hospital food. And I'm going, it's a figure of speech and a talk, and if you know, which effectively it is. In hospital, if you are fed with diabetes, ice cream 3 times a day, those people will leave with the impression that that's what the hospital wants me to eat. And they guess what? They leave eating cornflakes, breakfast cereal, biscuits, ice cream, fruit juice. And so I do believe it is effectively killing my patients because they've learnt that bad behaviour in hospital. But the medical board felt that I'd been exaggerating the situation because none of my patients were ever proven to die from the hospital food.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then that second complaint, they actually asked me to supply a copy of my talk before I gave it. Now that's actually starting to infringe on free speech. You know, I'm an invited speaker. I'm not working with for the hospital at that point in time. I'm independent. And so we've got a medical regulator. As I say, this is star chamber stuff. You should not be encroaching on my rights of free speech. And the first rule in medicine is physician do no harm. And it's the care of your patients. I don't care about processed food industry's influence within the hospital. But if it gets in the way of my patients, then I do care. And that's really what this is boiled down to.
Did the same thing happen to Tim Noakes? I don't know his story as well as yours, but was it the same sort of thing that he was recommending a lower carbohydrate or a lower sugar diet to his patients and then had legal action or disciplinary action taken against him?
Well, no, Tim's was more about, he did one tweet when a woman asked him about whether or not it was safe to give bone broth or, you know, to low carb food or banting to a baby in transition. And of course it is. You know, that's what we're just, you know, I'll come back one huge step. Low carb, healthy fat, banting, paleo, or keto at this point in time, it is the definition of real food. So I've actually like to rewrite the dietary guidelines, and I would like to rewrite them as eat fresh, local, seasonal, whole food based on your culture and environment, reducing added sugars and processed food. Now, that is really safe, benign. But if you think about it, if you eat fresh, local food and seasonal, for the vast majority of the year, you're not going to be eating fruit.
Exactly.
You're not going to have a high intake of grains because they're not actually local, seasonal. You've got to break them with your teeth. And it's low in carbohydrate, normal amounts of protein, and a healthier amount of an adequate amount of healthy fats. It's not dangerous. And that's what LCHF is. Now, that's real food. So Tim and I were both recommending real food both to our patients. He was doing it in a single tweet.
Low carb, high fat, the LCHF.
Well, I call it low carb, healthy fat. I mean, I draw that line because it's higher than what the dietary guidelines are, but it's healthy fats to satiety. It's not, you know, and we can get on. I don't like talking about macro percentages. It's about, for me, it's I have a very low carbohydrate diet. I have protein that I require, and that will depend on age, will depend on activity. That's my recommendation. And then you eat health fats to satiety. And your body will tell you that if you start listening to it. If you get all the processed chemicals out of your body, particularly if you get the sugar and the fructose out, the body will start telling you very clearly. And if you listen to people who travel this pathway, it may take a year, it may take 2 years, but you know, you've been doing it for a while, you'll wake up and go, actually, I need protein today, or actually, I feel like a bit more fat.
You can absolutely feel it, and I often do. And you were saying banting. Is that an Australian term that means like keto or low carb?
It's a South African term.
Okay.
But in fact, banting, I could be corrected. I think he was originally British.
Mm-hmm.
Or US. But the banting diet was in 1870s.
1870s.
Yeah. So he was describing that way back. He was an undertaker who lost a whole lot of weight by reducing carbs. And he was writing this as an undertaker, wrote the book. It's really probably the first commercial diet book. And so it's been called, but it's the same thing. It's the same description. It's called banting in South Africa, and Tim was recommending that. And in Australia, it's called low carb. Some people, you know, Sweden, a lot of places called low carb, high fat. High fat just tends to be, excuse the term, less palatable. You know, if you're trying to get your message across, whereas low carb, healthy fat.
Sure.
Or real food, you know.
It's whole foods.
Whole foods.
Yeah.
And keto is the current brand name, I suppose, for it.
Now, I want to hear about all of the stuff that you and your wife, Belinda, uncovered regarding the origins of dietary guidelines, because I think it really helps give people a sense, and it helped me understand why there might have been such a backlash against you and why all this might have gone down. So I want to get into that. But before we do that, I want to ask you what you think. Why do you think sugar is toxic? And then let's talk about grains. So I'm curious what you think the mechanism of sugar toxicity is, because there are people that argue the complete opposite side of the equation. You know, Ray Peet, people on the Ray Peet. Ray Peet is an American. Are you familiar with Ray Peet and his work? Yeah. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about the toxicity of sugar. I completely agree with you that sucrose, which is a disaccharide of glucose and fructose, if I remember properly, is, I agree with you, that I think it's a very toxic molecule for humans. But I think it's also interesting to look at the nuance and the detail there. What do you think is so toxic about, are we talking sucrose? Do you think glucose is toxic? Is it the fructose? What do you think?
Well, I've got a website, nofructose.com, and that's really where it started. Bearing in mind that the final metabolism of fructose was probably only described in about 2010 by Luke Tappie. So it's brand new. It's not in our textbooks. It goes fructose 6-phosphate, and then nothing. So I've gone back and looked at my old textbooks.
In glycolysis,
and that's where it is. So the modern understanding of fructose metabolism, and even the current textbooks, are very, very poorly. It's not there. So virtually most, and I haven't looked, I've got to be honest, I haven't looked in my current medical students' books to see what's in their physiology book, but it's brand new. So it's generations of people don't actually understand fructose metabolism. And we now know more about it. And so the long and the short of it, fructose gets metabolized down a few different pathways in the liver predominantly. Fructose has an aldehyde pathway, so it has an alcohol pathway. So all the byproducts of alcohol are pretty well there in the liver. It has a uric acid effect as well, in the fact that it inhibits that uric acid, the byproduct, inhibits a whole lot of things related to a thing called nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a major regulator of circulation to the brain, to all of our blood vessels, hypertension. And it's also involved in the inflammatory cascade of how white cells migrate into damaged tissue. It's also got a major pathway of too much fructose going down into the LDL cholesterol pathway. So that's that. In fact, the small, dense LDL is one of the end products of it. So which we seem to think is actually a major component involved in arterial disease, microvascular disease.
So excess levels of fructose correlated with higher levels of small dense LDL.
Yes.
Possibly through insulin resistant mechanisms like we can talk about.
And it's got pathways through it. It affects insulin resistance.
So fructose can cause insulin resistance.
It's tied up at the muscle level. It's got it involved in the leptin effect as well. It also has a hypothalamic response. It actually goes to the nucleus accumbens, which is the addiction center. It's a really important molecule. And the small amounts that we would normally have in nature, which is eating seasonal fruit, are probably okay. So if you are literally a hunter-gatherer and you eat your seasonal fruit, and you remembering that fruit in nature is there to be eaten, in fact stuffed in your face, so you can actually eat more, eat which gets turned into fat for winter hibernation. That's what, if you think about fruit and fructose and think about I'm eating it to get fat for winter, then it drives all those behaviours. It actually gets stored as fat. There's effects on the brain to actually make you eat more than you possibly can. And in Australia, we've got possums that will come through and strip a fruit tree bare in a night about 2 or 3 days before the fruit's actually ready for us to eat, because they want it to get fat. Bears would want it to get fat for winter hibernation. So just think about what fruit does. It drives behavior to get fat. So forget all all the biochemical pathways are there. And if you actually eat too much fruit, you see monkeys in the wild that actually get drunk. Yeah. And if you eat too much sugar, guess what? A few hours after you've eaten it, you get tropper, you get fall asleep. So, and we see it with kids at a party. If you give kids at a party sugar, they'll go and run around crazily. And then a few hours later, they're cranky and tired. And so you can almost see that drives behavior, agitation. A few hours later, makes you want to lie down and rest. So that's sugar. Just imagine, if we gave everyone on the planet sugar at the one time. Well, you'd see anxiety, you'd see depression, you'd see, all the emotional responses that we're actually seeing in society today. And guess what? Everyone's having sugar at the one time at the moment. So it's look out the street window. It's all happening in front of us. So, but again, it's the excess. So if you have your fruit in season, and I often talk about that environmental thing in that food guideline, our latitude, our exposure to sunlight, our exposure and production of vitamin D actually determines what happens with the metabolites of fructose. So in a tropical climate, you can actually have more fruit in your diet because you've got actually more sunlight exposure, so you're actually getting rid of those LDL particles at a subintimal layer in the blood vessels. Whereas the more temperate you get, the further you get away from the equator, probably the less sugar you can cope with, the less fruit you can in your diet. So I think it's fascinating. And again, this is all brand new stuff, but if we actually look at fructose in excess, then that's a problem. The thing where carbohydrate comes in, which is where the grains, the cereals, is that, and that was a real clincher for me in 2013, is a thing called the polyol pathway. The polyol pathway is where we convert excess glucose into fructose. And back to a 1970s paper, if you are insulin resistant or with an elevated blood glucose, then you don't convert. So normally you convert 3% of glucose in the bloodstream to fructose. That's called the polyol pathway. But if you in fact are insulin resistant, you're in fact turning 30% of the glucose into fructose. So when people are having high carb diets, they're not actually just having the fructose half of sugar in their diet, they're actually having 30% of the carb load, which can be hundreds of grams
of glucose. The glucose polymers, which form the complex carbohydrates.
That's right. As it gets broken down out of a complex carbohydrate just into the simple molecule of glucose, 30% of it is converted into fructose. And that, I think, is the runaway train of modern disease. Because we've just been blaming fructose, but in fact, 30% of people who are overweight and obese is getting converted into fructose as well. Add in the polyunsaturated oils, which then forms into the lipoproteins, and that the inflammatory polyunsaturated oils have got lots of double bonds in them, the points of oxidation, the points of inflammation. So that was the perfect storm. Fructose in your diet, but the massive carb load that the population is exposed to means a whole lot more than we ever thought is actually being converted into fructose, on top of the glucose being stored as fat. But that polyunsaturated oils comes in, and so it's not one, it's not two, it's actually all three. And guess what we've done in the last 40, 50 years? We've actually increased the consumption of all three. We've, you know, fruits readily available all year round. Processed food now is high in sugar, high in fat, and it's high in the polyunsaturated oils. It's carb loaded. We've created the perfect storm, because that's what the bliss point of food is. That's how food's been designed to be addictive.
It's this completely unevolutionarily consistent. It's a situation that is so inconsistent with evolution, right? In nature, it is so rare to find carbohydrates, depending on the latitude and the season. It's very rare. We would never have found seed oils. We would never have found polyunsaturated fats like you're talking about. They just don't exist in nature in the same proportions that we're finding them now in our diets. But food manufacturers are putting them into foods because they are preservatives and because they are cheaper to use. We would never have had canola oil or soybean oil or any of these oils in our diets in the past. And we would never have had this amount of carbohydrates. If people go backpacking, they'll see that carbohydrates are not available in the natural world very much. And there are some variants based on latitude and time of year. But even in, you know, cultures that hunt tubers, those tubers are small, they're rare, they're much more fibrous and less palatable than what we see. And so I think that people forget that this is the perfect storm. This sucrose, which is fructose and glucose, so excess fructose, and then getting fructose in excess from high fructose corn syrup, or getting fructose in excess from high fruit consumption that is unseasonal or unnatural, or fruit that's been hybridized to be higher in fruit, plus excess carbohydrates, overall excess carbohydrate load that we would not have had evolutionarily, like you're discussing this polyol pathway by which excess glucose can actually get converted to fructose. And that in combination with seed oils, which people like Tucker Goodrich have talked about, these highly polyunsaturated oils with multiple double bonds, which are very susceptible to electrophilic attack, becoming free radicals and lipid peroxides, creates a whole lot of dry wood and a lot of sparks, and it just creates inflammation. It's just a fireworks display next to somebody that's smoking a cigarette all the time. It's just waiting to go up with a bang in terms of inflammation. And I think that's because it's evolutionarily something we would have been programmed to get because it was so rare. And that evolutionary program is having us seek things that will help us survive. And now we have it in abundance. And I think manufacturers have figured this out. Those fat cat cereal manufacturers at the golf course in 2014 who are plotting against you, they figured it out. They figured out that if you give people, if you give humans the evolutionary rare foods, they will go crazy for them because our programming is telling us to get those foods because they're so rare, because they're so caloric. We have no satiety mechanisms around them. But what they're all doing is they're just drugging us. They're kind of making us the rat in the cage with this irresistible food because it just short circuits our neurobiology and our evolutionary programming.
Yeah, I actually call it Soma from Brave New World, you know, effectively drugging out the population.
Soma is a compound in that book
to keep the people happy.
Right. Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
And so I reread Brave New World only a year ago, and guess what? It's happening. And
the opiate of the peoples.
Yeah, just keep everyone happy, you know, and then throw in a bit of ongoing, you know, lots of platforms, you know, social media, reality TV. Let's just keep everyone happy, subdued, sick, requiring the pharmaceutical industry to keep us all in that position. We don't have a health system. We have a sickness industry. And you know, we can break out of it. That's the really fascinating thing. So, you know, over the years, I've been talking about the science. You know, other people on your podcast around the world are talking the science. But my medical board wasn't listening to the science. They were listening to the influences that were affecting it. So Belinda, her work... Belinda's work has been... significant over the last several years. She's been saying, you guys are talking about the science, you know, but nobody's listening. So why isn't anyone listening? And what she's uncovered has been related to that, and it's, you know, it's phenomenal. And I implore everyone to actually start looking at her work and certainly what's going to be coming out over the next 12 months. But effectively, she said she looked into the expert witness against me. And the expert witness, very high in the nutritional world, a recent president of the International Union of Nutritional Science or Services, we can come back to them. But at the time, he was working for one of the breakfast cereal manufacturers. And literally, I mean, I'm just an orthopedic surgeon in the back end of the world in a place called Tasmania, and at the time I only had a couple of thousand followers on Facebook, and sure, I was making a little bit of noise, but I'm just a little guy. Why bring in the world, one of the world's biggest experts to hit me? It's like hitting a sledgehammer, using a sledgehammer on a mosquito. It's just completely disproportionate. And then she started looking into him, looking into Sanitarium, in fact, looking into his, you know, what his partnerships were, including his wife and who she was working with. And then we've come across the role of the cereal industry, the role of the food industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and in fact the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and the role of ideology in this. And we held on to this information for a couple of years because we couldn't believe it. And so, and ultimately we put it all together. We went and caught up with some friends in Wales, Zoe Harkham and her husband, and Marika Sorbus flew in from Cape Town, and we just said, we want to tell your story. And there were five of us in a little Welsh village, and no use ever trying to track Zoe down because Welsh names are completely impossible to find out. And we sat there for 5 days with five laptops going, the five of us, trying to disprove what we'd found. And at the end of 5 days, they said, you're absolutely right. So what we've in fact found, and we talked about this in 2017, CrossFit Games, and there's a talk that I've done about the central role of nutrition in everything, which brings a whole lot of it together. Belinda's, you know, given some talks since then, there's a few podcasts out. The cat's out of the bag now. Effectively, we have our dietary guidelines that have been written by the cereal industry, based on the ideology of the Adventist Church, which is the Garden of Eden diet. That's the vegan diet. So if you look at the food guidelines now,
and these are not just Australian food guidelines. These are worldwide guidelines.
If we look at the food pyramid, we look at the MyPlate, we look at the Australian healthy food guidelines in Australia, you look at whether it's happening even in Canada recently where they're changing it up. They are cereal-based, anti-meat, anti-dairy, rapidly vegan, vegetarian. And if you look at, and we've done the evolution over the last, you know, I did that in my talk. Look what's happened over 100 years. This is what it was in the 40s, the 50s, the 70s, and the 80s, the 90s, and this is where they are now. They've evolved. And when you realize that they were started by the Adventist Church in 1917, Leonard Cooper was the initiator of the American Dietetics Association, October 1917. She was working for John Harvey Kellogg in that time frame. She was a Seventh-day Adventist. She was a vegetarian, probably vegan. The term vegan didn't start until the 1940s. And the whole cereal-based thing came through. Now, everyone thinks, oh, crikey, you know, that couldn't possibly be. But the Dietetics, American Dietetics Association model was followed right around the Western world, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. Those people then effectively writing the dietary guidelines for each of those countries. And what happens in the US is pretty well adopted around the world. Leonard Cooper was also writing the textbooks for the next 30 to 40 years, which became the textbooks for around the world, including nursing textbooks. So there's a term I use called generational education. You believe your teachers because that's what they tell you. But if your teachers have believed the same thing and believed the same thing over and over, that's continued on. So hand in hand with that, where the introduction of vegetarian guidelines by these boards, if you look at the people, like the US one, there were 9 people involved in those initial acceptance of the vegetarian being safe. 8 of the 9 on it were vegans or vegetarians.
And what year was that?
That was the 80s.
1980s.
1980s, where the vegetarian diet was being promoted. And 5 of the 9 were Adventists. And the 9th person was actually working for the processed food industry, which comes back to ILSI, which is the International Life Sciences Institute. So on one arm, one side of it, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the right arm of the church is medical evangelism. They wish to promote health, well-being. They're well-intentioned. Everything I'm saying, by the way, was acknowledged last year, 2018. They came out with an article. Interestingly, one of the lead authors there was Joan Sabat. Joan Sabat is an Adventist. Joan Sabat is currently sitting on the American review panel of the Dietary Guidelines and hasn't declared his conflict of interest as being a vegan Seventh-day Adventist.
He has not.
No, not as of today that I'm aware of. So if I might be wrong by the time this goes out. But we've got someone here who... So the Garden of Eden diet, which was proclaimed, which was just fruit, nuts and seeds, didn't have anything about legumes, by the way, but fruit, nuts and seeds, the Garden of Eden diet is seen as the diet for salvation. It's not based on health. It's an anti-meat agenda because meat causes masturbation, meat causes violence, meat causes cancer.
This is the Seventh-day Adventist thinking.
And this is all end of the 1800s. You know, this is not new. So they've been promulgating that for a long time. Then we've got the meat causes heart disease, that was the latest, that was the early 1900s, which kept on going through with the whole cholesterol thing. And then we've got meat causes cancer again, which has been around for a while. And now we've got meat is bad for the environment. This is all made up. And it's all based on religious ideology, not biochemistry.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So if we get down to biochemistry, that's the Krebs cycle. You know, the body will happily take in, the mitochondria will happily take in carbohydrate, protein or fat, and it all gets turned into acetyl-CoA, gets turned into ATP, which is the energy of life itself. And God, you know, in whatever form, is not stupid. God would not make a seasonal, completely dependent on one fuel source, which is seasonally available, which is called carbohydrate. God's far cleverer than that. So we need to be understanding that our food guidelines, and the introduction of cereal, like cereal was, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, made up term, Ellen G. White, then gets adopted and promulgated by Kellogg's, Lena Cooper. It all happens there. It's all there. It's all forms there. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day. In fact, breakfast cereal is the most important meal of the day. But then you've got to, and most of your listeners are hoping, have heard now that why breakfast cereal was invented. And Kellogg's invented cereal to quell our lustful thoughts, to stop us from masturbating.
When did that happen?
Well, that was the late 1800s, 1890s that he started developing. But you've got to remember that John Harvey Kellogg, at the age of 12, was adopted into the White family, and as a 12-year-old was typesetting the works of Ellen G. White, her writings. And her first writings was about a letter to mothers to stop your children from masturbating, so that if you do masturbate, you're going to defile everything and you're not going to go to heaven. So you can imagine a 12-year-old doing the typesetting, reading that if you are going to masturbate, then you are going to be going to hell, effectively, or you're never going to get to heaven. So he was completely brainwashed, and he was then raised, and he had his strange ideas, and he was up to all sorts of strange things at the Battle Creek Sanitarium, and all sorts of devices. He's right into the whole development of the modern concepts of circumcision, clitoral ablation. It was completely bizarre, but imagine him being brainwashed as a kid. So then we've got this. So, and then cereal was in fact invented to actually develop a bland food to quell our lustful thoughts. And then in Battle Creek, Michigan, 101 cereal companies of the world were developed. It started there, most of them by the Adventists, and over time they all conglomerated. They came down to less and less. But we're talking effectively the cereal industry has had its influence right at the beginning of the Dietary Guidelines, and it's flowed right through. In a really kind of crazy way, if you can think about that whole bottom of the food pyramid, which most people are still influenced by, all those cereals and grains are there to stop us from masturbating. I mean, it's laughable, yet it has actually been a critical point in the turning of our health equation, because we've now had this high carbohydrate load affecting that. Now, we then look go forward from there and what they've been up to. You've got to then think about where Ansel Keys, everyone think, you know, Ansel Keys, a lot of people have heard about him. But the question is, what was influencing Ansel Keys? And really, really interesting stuff there. Ansel Keys was doing his starvation diets, and the people who was doing the starvation diets were the conscientious objectors. The conscientious objectors were the Seventh-day Adventists. So he was clearly around the Adventists and their low-fat, anti-fat, anti-meat philosophy. I'm not saying he was, but clearly there was influence at that point in time and before he started doing his all of his studies.
His seven-country study, which was, I believe, in the 50s.
Yeah, but go back to the 40s, he had a significant involvement in those starvation studies.
With the Seventh-day Adventist population.
Well, with their message.
Right.
Yeah. So, because everyone's blaming Ansel Keys, but we've seen, okay, we've gone back before that. Well, Belinda's gone back before that. Who influenced Ansel Keys? Where were we? And that's where it came back to 1917. And then she's gone back to the whole temperance movement climate in the 1850s. You know, which was, if you look at that time frame, we had a period when water wasn't sterile, so people tended to drink more alcohol or a light beer, and so therefore people were half drunk, and therefore there was more violence and there was more infidelity. It was also the time when people came in from the farms into the cities. So the men were more alcohol, more violence, you know, they were away from their families and promiscuous and all that sort of thing. You've also got a time frame when meat wasn't available from the farm, it was being transported in. So the meat transported in, by the time it got there, it wasn't safe to eat. So I'm actually okay with the anti-meat agenda in the 1850s. Before refrigeration. So you throw into that, to try and preserve the meat, they salted the meat, but the salt wasn't enough. So again, where do we get this myth about meat being bad for you? Well, actually, maybe it was before refrigeration. Where do we get this myth that salt's bad for us? Well, maybe it was before refrigeration because they salted the meat, the salt wasn't as good. Pork transported badly in comparison with maybe beef. So pork's worse for you. It's all tied up there in history. And we can't go back to the 1850s to unravel it. We can only look at the texts that came through from that and the origins, particularly of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and of which the writings of them have been, they're all there. There's significant amounts of them that are there. And when you look at it, it's all happening. Now, as I said, you know, Joan Sabat in his article last year they've actually acknowledged everything I've said here.
And where is that? Where can people find that article?
It's a journal called Religion.
Okay.
And I think it's the role of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in affecting the food guidelines.
I'll see if I can find it and link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's there. Belinda's, it's on. There'll be a link to it on the I Support Gary website and,
great,
and Belinda's work there. I think the articles are Where Did the Meat Go?
Mm-hmm.
So it's all there. It's all acknowledged. And in fact, Belinda's work is actually acknowledged in the references. So the Seventh-day Adventist Church acknowledge that she knows more about the Seventh-day Adventist Church than they do. And so Belinda's been contacted by current Adventists, past Adventists, acknowledging everything that she's talking about is right. So we're not conspiracists. We're not anti-religious. Belinda used to be a Sunday school teacher. She's found this incredibly confronting and challenging. But as it's turned out, we're seeing their influence further and further. And the Adventist Church, over the last 100 years, has positioned people into the highest levels of the dietary guidelines within the World Health Organization, within the United Nations, within the advisory boards across the world, within the US Congress. It is just fascinating how far it's gone. But they have a purpose, which is promote the Garden of Eden diet, the vegan diet, to the point where it's there for salvation. And when it happens, when enough people know on the planet, Christ will return. And I'm okay with people having a belief based on ideology, and what they want to do with it's fine, but it shouldn't be forced upon the food guidelines which determined what my children eat in school, what my family are forced to eat in hospitals, nursing homes, what happens with our prisons and our defence forces. And that's where it is. And that's our beef, literally, excuse the pun. That's our issue. We need to actually get it out. It shouldn't be the go-to defence mechanism. The default position on a computer is safe mode, isn't it? The default of our biochemistry is nutritional ketosis. Because if we've got no food to eat, we go into nutritional ketosis. When an animal's sick, they go into nutritional ketosis. And actually, nutritional ketosis gets your phagocytes going, your macrophages, your white cells. It actually brings into response the right amount of cortisol. You mobilize everything. Nutritional ketosis is a safe mechanism for the body to go on. A high carb mechanism, which is forced upon my patients in hospital, actually slows up their immunity. And we won't have time today to talk about the fructose effect on phagocytes and almost used a four-letter word, but why on earth are my patients, when they wake up after an anaesthetic, given jelly, ice cream, fruit juice, white sandwiches, which is having an immediate
immunological effect.
Immediate. And it's also a fructose, so it's shutting down the blood vessels. Not a lot, but just a little bit. And so in my hospital, in my private hospital, my patients can wake up and get some soup and cheese. It's only taken 8 years to get to that point, if they want. And again, I don't force it down anyone. It's just and I have a lot of patients who are low carbers, and they come into hospital and say, "We can't believe this food. It's terrible." I say, "Well, if you want, you can order bacon and eggs for breakfast. You can ask for soup and cheese when you wake up after an anaesthetic." But that's taken years to get, just a little milestone.
Such a long journey. So what you're saying with regard, and this is what's so interesting, when I heard Belinda's talk, Belinda has a great talk on YouTube, which I can link to in the show notes as well, because this is so interesting. And this is one of the things that I wanted to communicate to people through this podcast, this idea that the nutritional guidelines in the U.S. from the U.S. Dietetics Association began with a religious agenda, connected with the Seventh-day Adventist Church, connected with Lena Cooper, connected with people, John Harvey Kellogg, who was influenced by the Seventh-day Adventist, who was essentially brainwashed when he was a child. And their intentions, I think, were not malicious. But what is happening is that they are trying to prevent libidinous activities, which is probably the way a human should be. When we have working hormones, we do have sexual urges. But it sounds like their entire intention is to prevent carnal desire, to prevent us from having a hormonal system that works by replacing many of the foods in our diets, which are nutrient rich and which allow us to be hormonally healthy, that is meat and animal products, allow us to thrive, with carbohydrate grain-laden cereals. So as you were saying, John Harvey Kellogg had the intention of creating cereals to help control sexual desires at a time in human history when there was a lot of alcoholism, when there was a lot of infidelity, when the Seventh-day Adventist Church saw a real need for this sort of intervention. And so I like what you're saying, that we're not saying that religion is bad or that these agendas are malicious, but I agree with you that it does not seem like the right thing for humans to have nutritional guidelines based on control of normal human physiologic processes with increased grain diets, and we should not be told what to eat. And the other thing that you're saying, which is so impactful, and I want people to be aware of, is that the Seventh-day Adventist Church has a great amount of influence now, and they are highly influential on a number of nutritional boards. They're in the highest levels of government, and this kind of explains what we're seeing today, that so much of the agenda, so much of the political agenda around food is going plant-based because of this political influence that the Seventh-day Adventist Church might be having.
It gets more complicated or simple from there. You have to realize that they were the birthright of the cereal industry of the world. They also effectively started the soy industry, the Western soy industry. So Harry China Miller, which is an Adventist doctor, effectively brought soy from the East to the West, infant soy formula. So they're effectively behind the soy industry of the world, the commercial side of it. And they started the alternative meat, the fake meat industry. John Harvey Kellogg came up with nut meat analogs, in I think 1890s again. Very clever guy, you know, invented this stuff. They were looking for alternate food sources so that it would suit the Garden of Eden diet as prophetized by Ellen G. White. So they are the soy industry. They are the cereal industry. They are the alternative meat industry. And if you track most of these industries down, they are all tied up with an incredibly wealthy church. They're only small in number, highly influential. They position themselves into health reform for the world. They are the second biggest educator after the Catholic Church worldwide. They own numerous hospitals. They own 28 hospitals in Florida alone. So if you think – and then – so they are the food industry as well. There's, you know, big players in the food industry. They then over time – so their commercial arm fits nicely in with their ideological arm. And as a result of that, that has influence. The other side of that is that they are involved in medical education. And the other – so in the last few years in particular, there have been – the term exercise is medicine. Most people have heard that, you know, exercise more, you know, exercise more, eat less meat, as Belinda says, eat less meat. There's this argument. So exercise – it sounds good, you know, exercise more, eat less. And – but exercise as medicine is actually a trademarked term. Exercise as medicine, that trademarking effectively came from Coca-Cola funding. Coca-Cola, and you know, again, this is my talk here in San Diego, Coca-Cola were involved in the development of, they were behind funding for the Center of Disease Control, the Chinese Center of Disease Control. They were founding members of ILSI, which is the International Life Sciences Institute. Look up ILSI and you will see big food and pharma, top to bottom. Their scientific arm of the food industry, their research arm is ILSI. And ILSI is reaching into every hospital, every university in the world. If you're trying to get research money, it's always a struggle. But they're coming to ILSI, it sounds pretty good. They'll supply the funding as long as the message and the answer is what we require. So what's happened, particularly in the last few years, is you've got this whole plant-based agenda coming down through the educational arm. Tied in with that, you've got exercise as medicine, which is actually ILSI, Coca-Cola, pushing exercise. And they are forming LMED, which is one of the current arms. So when you see lifestyle medicine, that's in fact Seventh-day Adventist origins. Now with Coca-Cola funding and linked up with ILSI to promote the whole concept of lifestyle medicine. Sounds great, you know, eat less, exercise more, get your sleep, get the rest, get the right community involved, but eat less meat, plant-based is the message. And when you actually take it down and all of their programs, including the CHIP program, which is it's about veganism. And so the problem with that is that that's now becoming the medical curriculum. And it's being introduced in 8 universities in the US at this point in time. We only thought it was 5 up until 3 days ago, and we've just been told it's now 8. So we've now got a whole generation of medical students who are being told, move more, eat less meat. And that's becoming the curriculum. The moment it becomes the curriculum, because the guidelines are, you know, cereal-based anti-meat, as we talked about, when we have now a generation of doctors potentially going to come through who are in fact going to be doing harm, poisoning the next generation. And, you know, it's happening. And so we need to put a stop to it. Let's get people saying, what are the problems of eating real food? There aren't any. What are the problems of eating processed food? Well, that is a fad diet. We've been doing that for 100 years. It's screwed up. That's where we're at the moment. So our work, Belinda's work, is about letting people know where your education is coming from. Being aware that if you hear the term plant-based, understand, or the plant-based diet or the anti-meat agenda, realize that that's based on ideology and not biochemistry. And that'll be our message. Work out that this is not science. It is certainly not health as you extrapolate it down the path. And we've already got a health disaster. It's an economic disaster. It's a health disaster. It's a social disaster. And it's rapidly becoming an environmental disaster, which is one of my favourite side topics. cereal monocultures, soy, sugar, that whole grain industry, anti-meat is meaning we're taking nutrients out of the soil. The soil's getting eroded by wind and rain, and our health literally is being exported into the oceans. It, you know, we've got a grandson. You know, we want him to have a future. And that's that. This is, we care so much about this, we no longer care.
It's a scary thought, especially what you're talking about now with medical education. I've talked about this a little bit in the past. I was not taught much about nutrition in medical school, but to think that ILSEE can infiltrate medical education is terrifying. And to think that medical students are being taught these, as you suggest, religious ideologies, these religious agendas rather than science-based agendas is pretty bleak. And I think that we really need to work hard to reverse this. I just want people to understand where all of this anti-meat fervor is coming from. And I think it's quite revealing to understand that it's probably coming from religious agendas, from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, rather than science. Because people, I mean, I was talking to a friend today, and he's been eating a carnivore diet, or he's been trying to eat more animal products, and he's trying to source them as well as he can. And he's talking to people at work. He works at Apple. And he said, they just can't believe that I'm not clogging my arteries with all this meat. And I just kind of shake my head and think, the general population is just brainwashed, just like John Harvey Kellogg was in 1917. Or, I mean, it's just, there's so much media propaganda now. It's who has the biggest megaphone. And hopefully we can be a part of undoing this. And I think the first step is understanding where this crazy notion that animal foods are bad for us and plants are the best thing that humans can eat is coming from. And I think, like you're saying, it's coming from a religious ideology that's being foisted upon us for religious reasons.
Very, very heavily supported by the processed food industry.
They're in bed together. This is a match made in heaven in some ways.
Well, I can understand them pushing the soy, the cereal, and the fake meat. But it's a really interesting combination with Coca-Cola and the exercise as medicine, because Ellen G. White didn't like those vices like too much sugar. So clearly there's been a compromise for the two to come together. And we call it the Church of the Adventists and the Church of Coca-Cola have linked up. They started working together in 2010, 2012 become a little bit more of a link, but it seems as though there was a significant injection of funding by Coca-Cola 2014. And you can see that in retrospect as to what's happened.
Is there evidence that Coca-Cola is funding the Seventh-day Adventist Church activities?
Look, I'd love to get into everyone's corporate books, wouldn't I? Look, we know that there are very senior people within Coca-Cola who are Seventh-day Adventists. So they've bedded down together in the last few years. That's the only conclusion we can draw. And there's... So, look, I think it's interesting times. I mean, the most important thing is when I'm being educated, I'd like to know where my education's coming from. And the more we've looked at it, the more we've realised they're vested interests. You know, there's corporate sponsorship of my textbooks. There's corporate sponsorship at a medical school of literature, of research. And the trouble is I've come to distrust it all. And so, therefore, you know, I come back to my food guidelines. What can be wrong with eating fresh, local, seasonal food, whole food, based on your culture and environment, reducing added sugar and processed food?
Like we've been doing throughout our entire evolution as humans. Yeah.
If it comes in a plastic bag or a cardboard box, it's been processed. And so I don't know the truth in my science, in my medical education now. And that's been confronting to me. But when you start looking into it, I have become very doubtful of everything. Thank goodness I'm an orthopedic surgeon. If something's worn out, I can put a new part in there. If it's broken, we can put it back in place. I thank goodness I'm in a medical specialty that I'm actually okay with. I'm comfortable with what I'm doing because it's pretty basic. But if I was, you know, if I was a general physician or in general practice and having to work out what drugs I should or I shouldn't be doing, I do know from my experience that if you actually put people back on a real food or you know, a proper human diet, you know, which has been there for evolution, that PhD, and you know, that's a proper PhD now, isn't it? A proper human diet. You know, and Ken
Ken Berry.
Ken Berry and I have been chatting about that the last few days. We had a good old chuckle about it, but that's the proper, that's the doctorate we all need. It's a proper human diet. And we can, we know that just we see people get better. We see them get rid of their diabetes. You know, I call it LCHF, I call all this the proper human diet. This is a fad diet. It's food against diabetes. And so we can turn around a lot and we can get people off medication. All of this is incredibly disruptive. Everything I've just said is disruptive. It means taking your buying dollar away from the corporates and putting it back in your local community. It means not requiring medication. It's taking money away from the pharmaceutical industry, away from the sickness industry. You as an individual can make that decision today. You can make those decisions to change your buying power this afternoon. If we all do it, it's incredibly destabilizing. And I've got the internal documents from the cereal industry. They are hurting. For them to do a briefing document back in 2014, the cereal industry is hurting. That's buying power. The cereal industry are being hammered on sugar. They've been hammered on carbohydrate now. Their last bastion. What's their last bastion of defense? Why do we need to have cereal?
Fiber.
Fiber. Okay. So therefore, if we take down fiber, okay, then the cereal industry is gone. And guess what? You don't need fiber in your diet.
Fiber is a straw, is just a weak adversary. Wow.
And so therefore, I personally think, and I cannot prove it yet, that the whole gut microbiome story is white noise. It is literally smoke there, smoke and mirrors to keep us confused about the benefits of fiber at this point in time. There's clearly something in the gut microbiome. I'm not saying it's not involved in the development of a whole lot of micronutrients in the body, but the requirement of cereal in your diet for that. Sure, and I actually like some vegetables in my diet. Okay, I like the variety, the texture. So I can get, if I want fiber, if I need fiber, and I don't actually know if I do, that it's not because of gut microbiome. You know, my gut microbiome will look after me quite nicely.
I will hopefully do many more podcasts in the future about the non-necessity or the dangerous implications for plant-based fiber and the gut microbiome, but I do not, for the life of me, I cannot figure out where all of these nutritional figureheads are getting this often repeated as canon notion that we need plant fiber for a healthy microbiome. And I would encourage everyone listening to question that notion vigorously, because I have not seen it in literature at all. I think that it is, again, smoke and mirrors, and I agree with you completely. And I wouldn't be surprised if this is just the last bastion of them holding on to some semblance of value for carbohydrates or plant-based carbohydrates or whole grains. Because if you look at the literature, I have not seen the literature to support the idea that we benefit from plant-based fiber from a microbiota perspective. And yet everyone wants to believe that that's the case. And if you listen to many other functional medicine doctors, they will tell you to eat as much plant-based fiber and as much variety of vegetables and fruit as possible. And I think that that is unsupported. And what I've seen and what many have seen clinically is that the reverse of that often results in profound improvements in GI symptomatology and overall health. So I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that the microbiome is a very valuable thing to study, and we know very little about it. And much of what we are being told now is complete, as my friend Tommy Wood would say, tassiography. It's reading tea leaves. It's voodoo. And that is unfortunate. I think it's misleading the general public in a major way.
I think the next few years are going to be very interesting. Hopefully they're not quite as troublesome as they've been for me for the last several, but it's nice to coming out the other side to a degree. We've still got work to do. We've got doing a lot of mentoring work, a lot of support work. But I think Belinda's work is critical as we move forward to actually understanding more and more about who the vested interests are, but particularly the individuals right today who are shaping our education and our food policy, because that's what's being determined in our schools, hospitals, nursing homes, you know, defence forces and the prisons. And that's an enormous amount of food policy. It's an enormous amount of buying power. It's an enormous amount of clout. But it's also an enormous tsunami of sickness that's being promulgated.
You know, I'd sat down with Ken Berry this weekend as well, And I think that as people are listening to this, maybe they're feeling a little bit despondent, but I will just add a little bit of a ray of hope here. One of the things that Ken said that struck me so much, and Ken, the episode I had with Ken probably will have come out a few weeks before this one. Ken was not particularly bullish on the notion that we were going to see a lot of change from the top down, from the political level. Ken felt like the best thing that we could do was what we're doing now, share information at a grassroots level and share good science from well-intentioned physicians, you and I and others, Ken and many others, and other clinicians, about the benefits of a low-carb, ketogenic, healthy fat diet so that people will have access to this as an option. And then as more and more people try this, there will be a tidal wave of people with better health outcomes who will be impervious to the antagonistic propaganda that will come against low-carb, high-fat diets, because they will know for themselves, they will know without a shadow of doubt that they feel better, that their health conditions have improved when they have changed their lifestyle. Because I think that the most vulnerable populations are those who are kind of in the middle, who have not tried low-carb diets, who have not tried carnivore diets, and they're just thinking, what should I do? Should I go vegan? Should I go more plant-based? Should I go more keto? And they're able to be swayed. And when people who have illnesses, who want to optimize, have gone to a low-carb, high-fat diet, have gone to a carnivore diet, I think that the majority, the vast majority, perhaps all of them, will experience something that cannot be undone by propaganda. They will know from personal experience that they feel the best in that way, that their GI symptoms resolve, that they have more stable emotions, that their psychiatric issues get better, that their sleep gets better, that their body composition gets better, that they have a healthy libido, not a carnal libido, but they have a healthy libido. And that will be our best defense against what is coming down from the politics at a higher level. Because as you're saying, many of these policies are being shaped at levels of power that are beyond what you and I can affect at this moment.
I know we're having a go at trying to affect them at that level as well.
That's fantastic.
So, but you know, when my fallback position is when you see the results, you cannot unsee them. And I came up with it a while ago, but that's what it is. And so for me as a surgeon and doctor, I cannot unsee them. You can tell me stop telling your patients, but I'm not. And so therefore my patients tell someone else. And this is at a grassroots level, and Ken and I are completely on board with this. It's the people that will determine this, the buying power. What you decide to eat or not eat, or even fast this afternoon, is buying power. And the market will respond to that. And I know they're responding because we've got a briefing document, 2014, saying profits are being affected. So add another 4 or 5 years to that, they know about what we're up about. And when you see the disinformation in the media, know that that's coming not from science, it's coming from the corporate pockets.
You mentioned earlier, and then we can wrap up, I don't want to take too much of your time, that ILSI was trying to get this curriculum, this Garden of Eden curriculum, into 8 medical schools. And I think I heard you talk about those medical schools on another podcast. Was Harvard one of them and some of these other like well-known programs?
Look, I'll just leave that under my wraps at the moment.
Okay.
Okay. Harvard, we could look at the origin of the Harvard nutrition, and that goes back to the food industry, actually. I can't remember if it's 4 or 5 leading food companies started Harvard Nutrition.
This is even the nutrition, the School of Public Health.
Yeah, the nutrition school.
Walter Willett.
It was started by the food industry. Nutrition Reviews was started by the food industry to actually advocate for their product. You know, Walter Willett, by the way, was also right there at the beginning of lifestyle medicine when it was known as the American College, the Christian School of Lifestyle Medicine. So it started by the Adventists. Walter Willett was right there at the beginning.
So it was the lifestyle medicine was previously called the Christian School of Lifestyle Medicine. Or something?
Gosh, I need Belinda here right at the moment. But it was in fact, and they haven't changed. So it is lifestyle medicine in all of its forms, in all of its hats around the world, has Adventist origins, mm-hmm. that are promoting, and the curriculum and the exam course has been written by the Adventists, and it's promoting the garden of vegan diet.
So we're talking Neil Barnard, Dean Ornish, Walter Willett.
They're all tied up in there.
Mm-hmm. Joel Kahn.
I don't know if I haven't seen Joel in Lifestyle Medicine, but every one of those other names has been right in there. James Rip, it's all tied up. Multiple dollars, multiple influence, multiple hats that keep changing, but it had its origins in the one form.
And what was the previous name of Loma Linda University? Wasn't it? Oh, it was. I heard you say this on another podcast. It had another, because Loma Linda University, so Loma Linda, California is a school of Seventh-day Adventists, right? So we just had a pause there because we looked this up. Loma Linda University used to be known as the College of Medical Evangelists. And clearly this is highly connected with the Seventh-day Adventist. This is where folks like Stephen Gundry have been educated and taught. And this is kind of the center of the Seventh-day Adventist movement, isn't it? And it's considered to be a blue zone. I've talked about this on other podcasts. I don't want to belabor it. I don't want this podcast to go too long. But if you look, there was recently a study. I don't know if you're familiar with this one. They looked at the sperm quality of men in Loma Linda, California. And what they found was that it was very poor in vegans and vegetarians. And they had poor motility and they had very poor numbers of sperm, suggesting that this blue zone was not quite as ideal as they had hoped. And I recently did a podcast with Stephen Gundry and I wanted to bring up that study, but I didn't get a chance. But yeah, Loma Linda, formerly the College of Medical Evangelists, to think that they're infiltrating medical schools and changing the curriculum is a scary thought, because medical students, I love what you said. When a physician has seen something, he cannot unsee it. I've heard other physicians say this in the functional medicine movement. The first time a physician or a trainee or a resident sees a patient with diabetes or an autoimmune disease get better with a ketogenic or an elimination diet, their whole world has changed and they can never unsee that. We are taught in medical schools that these conditions are untreatable, incurable. And in fact, many of them are quite malleable. They're quite treatable. And when we as physicians see that, we can never unsee that and we become curious. And if physicians don't see that, they stay in their sort of boxed in medical thinking and they're never able to get out of it. And the same thing for your patients and my clients and patients. When they have good experiences with this, when they feel better, when their diabetes gets better, when their autoimmune disease gets better, they can never forget about that, and they'll probably tell 100 people this. That's what we need.
They'll tell 100 people, which just need those 100 people to listen. And that's where the medical profession doesn't listen enough, and that's sad. But I do think there's hope. I come to meetings like this, and you know, I only go back several years, and there were just three of us that met in a room, had a chat. And then there were 12, and then there was 100. And then, as I say, you know, my Twitter feed now reaches more people every single day than I'll see in an entire lifetime of medicine. And that's growing. And it's not, you know, this is about supporting those people that want to make a change now. The science, I think, is incontrovertible. I mean, it is just, it's the Krebs cycle. It is it's the energy of life. It's nothing more or less. And if we want to pollute that with the wrong petrol, the wrong diesel in our engine, that's what we're doing. And that's been put there by the processed food industry based on ideology and not biochemistry.
Not science. And then they're using all of these smoke and mirrors epidemiology studies to confuse people and to tell them that meat is going to cause heart disease. And there's a real effort against this, though, in the popular media. And I tell people generally, when you see a study that says meat is bad, dollars to donuts, that is an epidemiology study. And when you and I can talk about the biochemistry and when we can get in a room and debate plant-based physicians, they will have nothing but epidemiology, which is observational research. And when we look at the interventional research, the biochemistry, the interventional research is entirely clear that meat is not bad for humans. The animal products are not bad for humans. The animal products do not cause heart disease, cancer, etc. And this is, again, this is a propaganda war of smoke and mirrors that we're fighting against. And I hope to be able to affect that and just share more of the truth with people. So I so appreciate this conversation with you.
Oh, we could probably keep going for another day or so,
but I know.
We better close up sometime.
Yeah, we should. So Gary, thank you so much for your time. I have one more question, and then I'll why don't you tell people where they can find you, where they can find your stuff, where they can find your Twitter and other things, because I'm sure they'll want to support you and hear what you and Belinda are up to.
Well, they can hear find us on Twitter, Belinda Fetke and Gary Fetke. Mine's Fructose No, but that's where I spend more of my time. Belinda's got a Facebook page called Belinda Fetke No Fructose. It used to be called Gary Fetke No Fructose, but we changed that from under medical board pressure. And Belinda's works predominantly on a website called I Support Gary, which has started to try and find this. And I've got another website, nofructose.com, which I apologize to everyone, needs a bit of updating, but there's links to videos and other sources on there. And one day I'll get it around to actually revamping and cleaning it all up. But we're there on YouTube as well. The stuff's out there. And it's really important that we just keep that message going, because when you start finding out about this stuff, you just go, we need to let a bit more people know.
And I think it's starting, and I think it can't be stopped at this point. The truth can't be stopped.
No, nobody likes being conned, and not when it comes to your health.
Yeah, right?
And so I was conned for too many decades. But yeah. I'm not anymore.
Not anymore. All right, this is the last question I ask all of my guests. What is the most radical thing that you have done in the last month? In the US, we use radical, like cool.
The coolest thing, is that we're here at Low Carb USA, and Belinda was the opening talk, and I was second or third last, and I was on the panel with Gary Taub, Steve Finney, Rob Size, and Nina Tykholz, and we're a couple of state school kids from the other side of the planet, a little place called Launceston, and there's not many husbands and wives that can actually bookend a Low Carb USA talk, and we are incredibly humbled by the fact that we're, you know, our message is being appreciated. And I used the word cool before I left. I said, this is cool. A couple of people from the other end of the planet are actually making a little bit of a difference. And, you know, our kids are proud of us. So if that's your definition of radical, it'll be mine today. But we think it's pretty cool.
I'd say that's pretty radical, my friend.
Yeah, okay.
I know that I appreciate your work. I'm sure that all of my audience will appreciate it. So thank you again. We definitely want to support you, Gary. So isupportgary.org.
.com.
And nofructose.com. I'll put it all in the show notes. Thanks for coming on.
Excellent.
I can't wait till we get to hang out again soon.
All right.
Thank you for listening to that, guys. I so enjoyed that conversation with Gary. He is a baller. They probably don't say baller in Australia, but he's whatever they say in Australia, like for a radical dude. Gary Fetke, he's a radical dude. He was such a good guy. Interesting story. Check out his stuff. And I think you will really benefit from that. So check out ancestralsupplements.com, SaladinoMD on Shopify.com to get 10% off. Check out my insider. It's the newsletter, fundamentalhealthinsider.com. Week or so. I might do one later today if I can get off my surfboard or the foil board. And check out Juve. I so appreciate these guys. I released a cool video with them this week. There's a blog post up on their site. We made this awesome video about light as a nutrient. juve.com/Paul. All right. That is it. That's all for this week. I got so much cool stuff coming up, you guys. I got amazing people coming on the podcast soon. I did another one with Dave Feldman and Siobhan Huggins on cholesterol. I'm hanging out with Dr. Mercola. I recorded a podcast with him that's coming up soon. I'm hanging out with Ben Greenfield next weekend. I'm going to see Ben Greenfield do the steak dance. And I got Georgia Ead coming on. I got Michaela Peterson, who I know has a steak dance. And I've got Sophia Clemens coming on soon. So the lineup is all stars. I appreciate you all. I hope you have a radical week and stay radical as always. Let me know what you're doing. If you guys do radical stuff, you better tell me about it. I'll see you soon.